In 1959, Oxford University Press published a 200-page book containing 451 translations, about half of them in English, of a single 16-line Latin poem, Ad Pyrrham, or The Ode to Pyrrha. The poet, now nearly forgotten, was perhaps the most influential poet of all time. His name, Quintus Horatius Flaccus, known in the English-speaking world as Horace. From Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to our weekly podcast, The After Dinner Scholar. Ad Pyrrham is just one of a vast corpus of poetry by Horace, who wrote during the reign of Caesar Augustus, that is, around the time of the birth of Christ. For 2,000 years, Horace was admired as possibly the greatest lyric poet in history, and then Latin, especially advanced Latin, became a thing of the past, and few were able to read his grammatically complex works. And today, of course, poetry itself has become passé. But at Wyoming Catholic College, Latin is a required subject, and poems are read, studied, and memorized. Latinist Eugene Hamilton, along with literary scholar Tiffany Schubert, have been helping a group of students work their way through a selection of Horace's odes in Latin. I asked Professor Hamilton about what makes Horace's poetry stand out.
For someone reading the poetry in Latin, the first thing that jumps out is his versatility as a poet. He is able to use all these different meters in Latin. He's adopting various lyric meters from Greek poetry. And whereas other poets of the day tend to specialize in a certain meter, say Virgil with dactylic hexameter, Ovid with elegiac couplets, Horace uses meter after meter, and they have all these fun rhythmics and fun sing-songy dance qualities to them. I'll compare, say, the opening of the Aeneid in dactylic hexameter, stately line, kind of feels like a iambic pentameter. So, arma virumque cano, Troie qui primus aboris, the stately Homeric line, with, say, the lyric dancing poetry of Horace. Here's one. Nunc est bibendum, nunc pede libido, pulsandaterus, nunc saliaribus. You can hear the dancing quality to it there with the fun syncopation in it. Here's another one. Persicosodi pueraperatos, displicent nexe bidera corone, mit de sectari rosaco locorum, sera moritur. So just a lot of fun to read his poem for the musical qualities that he has. Also something that I think Horace, maybe we take this for granted now. We have so many great poets to look back on in the tradition, but Horace, at the time at least, is, you know, looking at the Greeks and recognizing their greatness. And rather than going off his own and trying to write his own poetry in his own little bubble or something like that, he's recognizing their greatness, want to appropriate it, adopt it, use it, take what's good. And I think we should give credit to Horace and other Roman authors for doing that, for really joining into the tradition. And we tend to kind of look down a little bit on Roman literature in general as maybe not as original as Greek literature, but instead they're recognizing the greatness of the Greeks and then imitating it
and expanding on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Also, Horace as a poet, when I think of a lyric poet today, maybe a different role for what the poet is supposed to do. Horace sees himself, in one poem he calls himself the priest of the muses. And so he's joining together poetic artistry with religion, also politics. He lives at a very turbulent time right after the Civil War. Augustus has now emerged victorious. And he's seen his poetry to combine all three of those things and really wants to make a difference in the world following 100 years of civil war. And he's a mainstream poet, well, a lyric poet who's really going to make a difference with the educated elite, the leaders of the aristocracy. the role that he has, the civic role as a poet, seems to kind of stand out, at least today. It'd be hard to imagine a lyric poet being mainstream and really hoping to do all of those things, but Horace does.
Yeah, poets today are kind of a culture to themselves on the outside, mm-hmm. very much on the outside of the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. And also, Horace is, and I brought a poem we can talk about here. Rather than trying to express his innermost experience, a poet before him, Catullus, was writing love poetry about his own experience, autobiographical experience of love. Instead, Horace, in a lot of his poems, is offering moral teachings to friends. So he's pointing to a specific person and giving them a moral teaching with this goal of really making a difference in the Roman Empire with his friends.
Well, would you recite and then translate one of the poems for us?
Yeah, sure. You had mentioned you were interested in the Carpe Diem theme of Horace, and so I brought one that I shared with students. This poem has two themes to it. The one theme is Carpe Diem. We translate it in English as seize the day, and Horace is the one that coined that phrase. Really, though, it means carpe is pluck, like you would pluck a ripe fruit, pluck the day, and so time here is seen as something with a certain ripeness to it, a certain freshness that you want to catch time while it's ripe. So it certainly has that theme in this poem. But why should we do that? Well, the other theme is memento mori. Are you familiar with the phrase memento mori?
It's a phrase that was very popular in the Middle Ages. And yeah. Has sort of, we don't want to talk about it anymore. Yeah.
Horace didn't coin that, but the Romans, when a Roman general was victorious, he would lead his troops through the capital, and at the height of his glory, a slave would sit in him with the chariot and whisper in his ear. So as everyone's chanting his name and celebrating him, the slave is whispering into his ear, memento mori, remember that you will die. So Horace here in this poem is looking out at the natural world and seeing that the changes of the seasons take place, and that we too will die. And from that, we should carpe diem. And so here, let me read this poem. The poem has an interesting meter. It starts out with the dactylic hexameter, the first line of Virgil and Homer. But then the second part, the second verse, the alternating verse, is this last half of iambic pentameter. And it has kind of an abrupt ending. And so it seems like there's some sort of comment that Horace is making with the meter itself, that the flow of nature happens with the dactylic hexameter and the order, but then suddenly the shortness and brevity of life comes to an end quickly in that second verse alternated, that we're cut off. Here I'll read it. Diffugire neves, rediunt jam gramina campis, arboribusque come, mutat terra veces, et decrescentia ripas flumina praeteriunt. Gratia cum nymphis geminisque sororibus audet, ducere nuda coros. Immortalia ne speres, monet annus et omum, quae rapit hora diem. Frigora metescunt zephyris, ver proterit estas, in territura semo. Pomifer autumus fruges, se fuderit et mox, bruma recurit in airs. Damna tamen celeris reperant celestia lunae, nos ubi decidimus, quo paterene has, quo divas turus et uncus, pulvis et umbra sumus. Quis erarar yeciant, hodierne crastina sume, tempora di superi. Cuncta manus avidas fugient, he redis amico, quae dederis animo? Cum semel occideris, et de te splendida minos feciret arbitria. Non torquate genus, non te facundia, non te restituet pietas. Infernis neque nem tenebris Diana pudicum liberat Hippolytum, nec de tea valet tesseus abrumpere caro vincula pirito.
Now, I didn't understand all the Latin, but I did read the poem ahead of time, and an appropriate poem for the autumn.
Yeah, so I actually brought a translation with us of by A.E. Housman. He was very influenced by Horace, and he actually called this the most beautiful poem in Latin, and was quite taken by it. And so it's maybe I'll read a few lines of it and then stop and pause and talk about it a little bit and kind of compare. A good translation, I think, helps you go back and see the poem, the original, in a different light. This is a great translation. It's an interpretive translation. And actually, the more I read the translation and the original and compare the two, the more, the deeper reading I get out of the text. So he entitles it Dust and Dreams, which is an interesting translation of one of the lines we'll talk about, Dust and Dreams. The snows are fled away, leaves on the shaws, and shaws here means trees, and actually Latin's a little easier here, arbores. So the snows are fled away, leaves on the shaws, and grasses in the mead renew their birth. The river to the riverbed withdraws, and altered is the fashion of the earth. The nymphs and graces three put off their fear and unapparelled in the woodland play. The swift hour and the brief prime of the year say to the soul, thou wast not born for A. And A is forever, so you weren't born forever. So yeah, the poem starts out, the snows are fled away. So right now, at this very moment, the snows of winter, the dreariness of winter is gone. You look out, you can see the graces and the nymphs. So the beauty of nature itself personified in the nymphs and graces put off their fear and unapparelled in the woodland play. So the raw beauty, the naked beauty, as Horace says, literally nuda gratia, play in the woods. But at this heightness of beauty, they also have the teaching for us, thou wast not born for A. So in the Latin original, he's saying, don't hope for immortality, i.e. immortality of, say, Apollo or Venus. We're not going to be forever young like Venus or Apollo. And yeah, then he keeps continues on with the cycles of the season that we watch, but we're seeing them through this context, both of the beauty of nature, but also the reminder that it's not that forever, impermanence. Thaw follows frost, hard on the hill of spring, tread summer, sure to die, for hard on hers comes autumn with his apples scattering. Then back to winter tide, where nothing stirs. But oh, wherever the sky led seasons mar, moon upon moon rebuilds it with her beams. Come we where Tullus and where Uncas are, and good Aeneas, we are dust and dreams. I'm going to pause here. So dust and dreams. Moon upon moon rebuilds it with her beams. So Horace here is comparing the earth with its changing of seasons, where things do not last, with the heavens, with moon upon moon, which is immortal, is a cosmological view of the ancients. Everything, the moon and above, is immortal, whereas things below are not. Points particularly to great heroes of Roman history and mythology, Tullus and Uncas, two kings of Rome, and then even good Aeneas, Horace is writing this poem about the same time as Virgil is writing his Aeneas. So even where when Aeneas dies, he's going to leave, and what will remain? We'll say, we are dust and dreams. And the original Latin here is we are dust and a shade, dust and a shadow. I'm thinking of the shades of the Odyssey, of the Odyssey. Hausmann has the interesting translation of calling it dust and dreams. And so after we die in Horace's mind, this dream continues. He's very concerned with posterity. And you know, what is Horace dreaming of? Well, I think he's dreaming of us sitting down and talking about him and reflecting on his poetry and still learning from him and honoring his memory. Yeah, I'll keep going. So Torquatus, if the gods in heaven. And now he's finally addressing his friend Torquatus here at the very, very end of the poem. So Torquatus, if the gods in heaven shall add the morrow to the day, what tongue has told? Feast then thy heart, for what thy heart has had, the fingers of no air will ever hold. And the message here is carpe diem, although it's kind of brief and hard to get. So feast then thy heart, for what thy heart has had, the fingers of no air will ever hold. As authors reflect on the fall of the Republic, they point to the greed of individuals wanting to acquire wealth. And Horace here is criticizing that, but he's also criticizing trying to hoard onto things. He's criticizing the idea of possession in general. How do we possess things? How do we really take pleasure out of things? Well, if we try to hoard them, we're ultimately going to die and not be able to keep them, and we'll just give them to our heir, and then our heir is the one who's ultimately going to have them. But instead, Horace is saying, and literally in the poet, he says, the poem, if you give it to your friendly soul, if you give things to yourself, to your soul, then you will have possession of them. And so a different way of seeing possession. So if you can give them to your soul, what does he mean by that? Well, in enjoying them while you have. Say if you have, he has a lot of poetry about drinking and wine, and if you put the wine and you store it, hoping that it will get better with age, well, eventually you're not going to get to enjoy it. If you drink too much of it and then get drunk and have a hangover, well, you didn't really enjoy it that way either, with excess. Instead, Horace says, if you give it to yourself, enjoying it in the company of friends, then you really are able to enjoy it. So a different way of thinking about possession here. Let me read the last few lines. When thou descendest once the shades among, the stern assize, that means court here, so once you go down to the court in the underworld with King Minos, when thou descendest once the shades among, the stern assize and equal judgment o'er, not thy long lineage, nor thy golden tongue, nor thy righteousness shall friend thee more. So when you go down to the underworld, to Hades, and in Horace's understanding here, Torquatus, he's telling him, your lineage, nor thy lineage, nor thy golden tongue, your oratorical skill, nor thy righteousness shall friend thee more. Then he goes on with the last line. Night holds Hippolytus, the pure of stain. Diana steads him nothing. He must stay. So Diana wants to save her beloved Hippolytus, but she can't. And Theseus leaves Pirithous in the chain. The love of comrades cannot take away. And so nor can Theseus save his friend Pirithous from Hades. But then the last line, Hausmann has an interesting interpretation of it. So the love of comrades cannot take away. If you look at that just on the own, I think you get kind of a different perspective on this. On the one hand, time is providing limits, but it's also providing the container and the occasion for the love between comrades of Theseus and Pirithous, as well as the love between Diana and Hippolytus, as well as the occasion for Horace writing this beautiful poem.
you know, one of my questions was, you know, lyric poetry in Latin. Oh, great, some think, you know, a dead art form in a dead language. And how can we remedy that? And I think you've really helped us to do that. And I think our students, no doubt, are really struggling with the Latin, which is difficult. but I greatly appreciated being introduced to Horace, and I will certainly be reading more of him. So thank you.
Thank you.
If this podcast has enticed you to read some more poetry, Horace's odes are available online in English and in Latin. In addition, there is something to enjoying the good things of life that are before us for as long as God allows them to be before us. As the preacher in the book of Ecclesiastes put it, this is what I have observed to be good, that it is appropriate for a person to eat and to drink and to find satisfaction in their toilsome labor under the sun during the few days God has given to them. For this is their lot. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth, possessions, and the ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot, and to be happy in their toil, this is the gift of God. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.